Our reading is from John's Gospel, chapter 14, beginning at verse 28. Jesus said, "You heard me say to you, I am going away, and I will come to you. If you loved me, you would have rejoiced, because I am going to the Father, for the Father is greater than I. And now I have told you before it takes place, so that when it does take place, you may believe. I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming. He has no claim on me, but I do as the Father has commanded me, so that the world may know that I love the Father. Rise, let us go from here."
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Do keep Bibles open if you've got them there. And this white sheet, not the one with the baptism, but the other one, will be a great help as we look through the passage together. Insecurity is a bit of a buzzword in our society. Lots of talk in psychology, at least, about what insecurity is. According to one eminent psychologist, insecurity stems from, this is insecurity in a person, stems from perceiving the world as an uncertain and threatening jungle. And insecurity leads to all kinds of characteristics in a person, like turning inward, becoming more selfish and self-focused. I guess we all vary, don't we, on how insecure we feel about the world, about our place in it. And a large part of that will be because of our upbringings and all kinds of other factors. But the reality is, if we stop to think about it, from our perspective, the world does seem inherently uncertain. So apart from just ignoring this reality, perhaps distracting ourselves or denying it, what do we do? How do we counter those nagging insecurities we feel? Insecurities about our future, about the world, about ourselves. In this section of John's Gospel, we've been in this little bit of the Bible for 3 weeks now, and I've mentioned before, Jesus' disciples have just been told that he's about to leave them. He's about to go within the next 24 hours to the cross, and naturally the disciples are sad. We're told Jesus himself is pretty troubled about it all, but the disciples' reaction to this news exposes some pretty deep insecurities about how they view the world. So despite Jesus' assurances about the future, they're very fearful about what's going to lie ahead for them. And the world does seem for them like a threatening jungle. And just as the psychologists predict, what do? Well, they respond by turning inwards. They become more self-focused. That's what Jesus points out there in verse 28. They hadn't even considered how what's going to happen is going to affect Jesus. Verse 28, "You heard me say to you, I'm going away and I will come to you. If you loved me, you would have rejoiced, because I'm going to the Father, for the Father is greater than I." But clearly the disciples have just kind of shut down. They're focusing in on their small world. And so into this situation, Jesus teaches them something crucial, something which is going to enable them to maintain a joyful confidence and security in the midst of all kinds of bad circumstances which are to come. And the first thing he teaches them, and this is there at the top of the sheet, the main thing, is that behind the worst evil is the perfect plan of God. So let's look at verse 29. Jesus says, "And now I have told you before it takes place." Jesus is talking there about leaving them and going to the cross. Why is he telling them beforehand? So that when it does take place, you may believe. So for these disciples, what's about to happen in the next 24 hours, they're going to see their master taken from them, arrested, tortured, and then strung up to die on that blood-stained cross. This event has the capacity either to destroy their faith, to destroy their confidence in the future, or it has the capacity to establish their joyful confidence once and for all, so that they're then able to trust in any situation. And the difference between those two outcomes is going to turn on whether they get a deep understanding of what is really happening at the cross. We know, don't we, ships can be thrown about in a major way in storms. But if you fill a ship's keel with lead or with iron, it serves as a ballast so that it keeps them stable whatever the conditions. And it's the same for us. The deeper you and I grasp the cross in particular, that gives us ballast for life, gives us a strength of confidence, a joy throughout whatever storms happen for us. So Jesus continues, verse 30, I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming. So Jesus is saying that behind the events of the next 24 hours is an attack from Satan. He's here referred to as the ruler of this world. Now, I know immediately as I talk about the devil or Satan, for some of us here, that'll be a real problem. The idea of a personal, supernatural, evil person sounds primitive to lots of us. You know, are we really to take that seriously? In the West, at least, we've got rid of the idea of a cosmic, supernatural evil. We don't even like the word evil because it implies moral absolutes. Instead, we tend to use medical language. We talk about dysfunctions. So everything has to be explained in terms of either psychological dysfunctions, you know, we weren't raised right, or sociological dysfunctions, we've got the wrong social structures in society. There's a book by a secular liberal professor called Andrew Del Banco, and it's called The Death of Satan. I haven't read the book, but I've read some reviews of it. And the argument of the book is that the Western view, this Western reductionism, where everything is explained in terms of social or psychological causes, just doesn't work. And Del Banco says the problem is brilliantly illustrated in a scene from that book, The Silence of the Lambs. And in the scene, the FBI agent, Starling, she approaches an imprisoned madman called Hannibal Lecter, who eats his victims. And she says to him, "What made you like this? What happened to you?" That's the Western question, isn't it? What's the underlying cause? And he looks at her and he says, "Nothing has happened to me, Officer Starling. I happened. You can't reduce me to a set of influences. Can't you stand to say that I'm evil?" And this guy, Del Banco, he says the modern West cannot answer the monster's question. We've no longer got evil as a category. We can't use the term. People used to argue, didn't they, that racism and violence came from a lack of education, a lack of privilege. But of course, then we had the Holocaust, which arose out of a culture as educated as any culture on earth. Also in the 20th century, we had Marxism, which argued that our big problem is social. If we could just put the means of production into the hands of the workers, everything would be okay. But of course, when that happened, the workers were every bit as violent and repressive as the capitalists. And now Marxism is pretty much confined to the dustbin of history. So Western reductionism, Del Banco argues, cannot account for the depth and for the pervasiveness of evil. It just doesn't work. Jesus' teaching, on the other hand, which we're looking at here, Jesus says that there is a real supernatural evil, a real devil, a real evil in the human heart. And actually, Jesus' teaching makes much better sense. It's better at explaining the reality of what we see around us. So, of course, we do see psychological and social factors aggravating and shaping evil, but you can't reduce, evil is not reducible to those things. So that's to try and keep you with me if even the mention of Satan is turning you off. But Jesus is explaining here that the first explanation of what is about to happen is Satan. We've actually already been told that, clues about that in the previous chapter, chapter 13, that Satan has put it into the heart of Judas to betray Jesus. Then halfway through the meal they're sharing, we're told that Satan enters Judas. So we're being told that what is about to happen here on the cross is a premeditated, brutal onslaught by the devil himself. It's as if the serpent, that ancient serpent, is coiled and ready to give his most vicious strike imaginable on the Son of God. But Jesus is at great pains for us to see that that is not the deepest explanation of what is about to happen. So let's keep looking. So yes, the ruler of this world is coming, verse 30, but Jesus says, He has no claim on me. He goes on, I do as the Father has commanded me. Now, Jesus already said back in chapter 10, no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. Ultimately, Jesus says he's going to the cross, not because he's forced to, but because he chooses to. In fact, Jesus says there that he's going to the cross out of obedience to the Father's wishes. That's what's really driving this whole episode. It makes us question, what is this big plan of God that Jesus is so keen to cooperate with and to accomplish? And actually, John's gospel, which we've been looking at piece by piece, pulls back the veil and it lets us in on this great mystery. It tells us that Jesus has been sent into the world by the Father to accomplish a specific task. And it tells us that this task is to rescue a particular people by Jesus dying for them. And it tells us that this people are a gift from the Father to the Son. So when we put the pieces together, the roots of what we're seeing here, what's about to happen on the cross, the roots go back to an agreement. Some call it a covenant, the covenant of redemption is what theologians call it. But this agreement happened between the persons of the Trinity before creation. The Father promised to give a people to the Son as his inheritance. The Son agreed to accomplish his people's redemption. And the Spirit agreed to apply the Son's redemption to his people's hearts. That's why in Revelation chapter 13, Jesus is described by John as the Lamb who was slain from before the foundation of the world. This event was established between the persons of the Godhead before history even began. This is God's perfect loving plan. So in this verse, we see two main things Jesus is achieving on the cross. I'll put them there. Jesus goes obediently to the cross, firstly, to defeat Satan. Now, striking here in this verse, Satan is referred to as the ruler of this world. It makes us wonder, how did Satan end up in charge? Well, interestingly, the Bible tells us it wasn't a coup. It was an election. Humanity chose, we elected Satan to be our ruler. God created humanity as his image bearers to rule his creation. But if you know the Bible, our first parents, instead of trusting God, they chose instead to listen to submit themselves to the serpent, Satan, and to his lies. And from that moment, whether we realize it or not, humanity has been submitted, or has submitted itself, to satanic rule. And this world is full of false systems of thought and false systems of worship, which keep people locked up in darkness. Some of us will be thinking, well, hang on, you know, am I not the captain of my soul? Am I not the master of my fate? What someone did all those years ago, that doesn't affect me. Don't we all come into the world as little Adams, untainted by sin? But actually, I don't think we really believe that deep down. So when we see the girl born handicapped, or when we see the little boy born with congenital HIV, we don't immediately think, well, that must be because of something they've done wrong. No, we know, don't we, that we're all affected by the sin of those who have gone before us, especially our first ancestors. None of us are born in Eden anymore. I think we know that. But did you notice that Jesus says there in verse 30, Satan has no claim on me? It's quite a claim in the context. Amazingly, for the first time since our first ancestors, there is a human being who is not answerable to Satan. A person who was born of a virgin. He's a new humanity. A person who has lived a perfect life. Someone with no chink in his armour. There's no sin that Satan can sink his hook into. We tend, I think, to describe Jesus as sinless, which is true. But it describes what he's not. He's not selfish. He's not proud. He's not fickle. But when we leave it at that, I think it can leave us thinking that his life was therefore smaller. His life was more constrained than other people's were. But it wasn't like that. His life was bigger and freer. Jesus was brimming over with life. He was kinder than the summer. People found him so magnetic, they just wanted to be near him. That is what a truly holy life looks like. It's deeply positive. It's attractive. And it's because of this life that Satan has no hold on him. And it's significant here that Jesus says in verse 31, I do as the Father has commanded me. Of course, that is the exact opposite of Adam. So do you remember it was Adam's disobedience which plunged humanity under tyranny? And now it is Christ's obedience, willingly going to the cross, which lifts humanity to freedom. But then it's not automatic for us. I guess we all benefit from Adam's benefits, if you can call them that. But we're all part of his family automatically, just by birth. But that's not the way it is with Jesus' family. With Jesus' family, we need to be adopted into it. Each of us has to be individually put our trust in Jesus to get his benefits. But wonderfully, now that the devil is defeated, we don't need to listen to his lies anymore. There's a book I found on our bookshelves called Lies Women Believe, which I can only assume was bought by JC. But I was looking at it. It's very interesting chapter headings. I haven't read the book, but each one is a lie that Satan feeds to people. And some of them are particularly relevant to women, but lots of them are very general. Things like, God is not really good, or God doesn't love me, or God's ways are too restrictive. And there's 40 of these. But the point is, because of Jesus, we are now free to replace those damaging, crippling lies with the truth which sets us free. And of course, now the devil is defeated. His accusations against us don't stick. Satan's always saying, you know, you've sinned, you deserve condemnation. And we feel that. And when that happens, we have to agree with him. That's excellent theology. Yes, I have sinned. I deserve condemnation. But that's not the whole story. Because we have to remind Satan the bit he's missed, which is that that condemnation has been taken on another. Jesus declared, it is finished. So we need to claim and acknowledge, experience that freedom from guilt which Jesus has won for us. And next there on the sheets, the next thing Jesus achieves by obediently going to the cross is a display of the Father's glory. The reason Jesus gives in verse 31 as to why he's going to the cross is not the reason that we would normally think of. Have a look, verse 31. But I do as the Father has commanded me. He's talking about going to the cross. But why? So that the world may know that I love the Father. We're thinking, what is going on there? Why is it so important that the world sees that Jesus loves the Father? I've been scratching my head about this all week, actually, and I'm not sure of all the reasons, but here is one reason at least. Actually, I think it's a reason which might be easier to understand for non, perhaps if you're from an Eastern background, than for some of us Westerners. When Adam sinned, it didn't just affect us and Satan. It affected God, God's reputation, his honour as one who is glorious in himself, as one who is therefore worthy of glad submission. That reputation, that glory and honour was dented. It was damaged. If you're familiar with the book of Job, this is one of the big themes in that book. Is God like one of those gnarly old billionaires who has to keep buying diamond rings and necklaces just to keep anyone interested in him? That's what Satan is saying in that book. Job only worships you because he knows that's where his bread is buttered. Or is God of such glory, such beauty, such worth, that even when he withholds his gifts, even when Job loses his family, his fortune, his health, everything, that even then God is still worthy of worship? That's the big question in the book of Job. And of course, Job's testimony is this: gifts or no gifts, God is still worthy of praise. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So here is one key reason why Jesus goes obediently to the cross. It's to display to the world the Father's innate glory, that Jesus loves the Father for who he is, even when that is immensely costly for him. And therefore, in going to the cross, Jesus restores the honour, the reputation that Adam has so damaged. Incidentally, this is why clinging to God in hard times is so important for us. So when we say, look, I'm only interested in you, God, so long as you deliver, so long as you give me the job I want, the partner I want, the children I want, and so it goes on. But as soon as you stop delivering on my demands, I'm not interested. When we approach God like that, with that kind of gold digger faith, it's not only deeply hurtful to God, it's declaring to the world that God is a bit like that gnarly old billionaire and that he couldn't possibly be loved just for himself. But rather, Peter tells us in 1 Peter 1, we're to cling to God in hard times, knowing that it will result in praise and glory and honour at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And that's a great motivator in hard times, knowing that it honours God to cling on to him. So Jesus is telling his friends here, yes, what is about to happen, what you're about to see at the cross, is satanic. It is horrific. It is evil. But, says Jesus, I am not controlled by it. I'm not controlled by demonic betraying or demonic false accusation or demonic torture. I'm controlled by love for my Father. Ultimately, evil does not call the shots. Love does. That is a wonderful truth to discover. Even at Jesus' arrest, when Peter tries to defend Jesus physically, Jesus says, do you think I can't appeal to my Father and he won't send 12 legions of angels to protect me? Jesus isn't forced into anything. He's going willingly. There's a lovely bit in the Jesus Storybook Bible where the people are mocking Jesus on the cross and they say to him, you know, if you were the Son of God, you would come down from that cross now. And the Bible then puts in an extra line and it says, and they were right, but they didn't understand. It wasn't the nails that kept Jesus there. It was love. It's a really beautiful line explaining what's really going on at the cross. And as we grasp that behind the cross, behind the worst evil ever, is this perfect, loving plan of God, as we grasp that more deeply, it frees us, it enables us to have, as I've put on the sheets there, joyful confidence in any circumstance. That's, of course, why Jesus is telling them this. He says that in verse 29. And now I've told you before it takes place, so that when it does take place, you may believe. One of the fascinating things about this teaching on the cross in these verses is that in this passage at least, it's not about us. The reason given here in this verse for the cross is not Jesus' love for us. Did you notice that? It's his love for the Father. Actually, even in Gethsemane, when in the garden that they're about to go to, when Jesus is in utter anguish about whether to go through with it or not, the final decider for him is not expressed in terms of his love for you and me. It's expressed in terms of his love for the Father. Not my will, but yours be done. Actually, that is strangely reassuring. It doesn't diminish Jesus' love for us, but it does set that love in its proper perspective. I have to say, we've got babies on the brain at the moment because we're expecting any day, and we've got a Christian parenting book called Baby Wise, and the book begins by explaining that the best thing for a baby's sense of security is for them not to be at the centre of their parents' world, which sounds, when you first read it, a bit odd and counterintuitive. But it says, if at all possible, make sure that the child sees the two parents relating to each other, chatting to each other day to day, as much as possible, without reference to the child. Because actually seeing the parents' relationship as the strongest bond in the family, that is what will give a child maximum security in life. I know that creates extra challenges for single parents, and that can be very difficult. But of course, when you see the effect on children of broken marriages, it does reinforce the wisdom of this kind of approach, that a strong marriage is the best gift for a child's sense of security. But when I first read that section in the book, I immediately thought of this teaching in the Bible. My security before God does not rest ultimately on God's love for me, however strong that love is. My security rests on the eternal, unbreakable love between God the Father and God the Son. And actually, there is nothing stronger in the universe than that. Nothing stronger in existence. And so the fact that my salvation is caught up in and rests in that relationship, that's an amazing, wonderfully comforting thing. And it's not just reassuring. When we think of how everything we have received from the Lord, the forgiveness, the new life, the future hope, the gift of the Spirit, when we think that it's all because we're caught up in the love expressed between the persons of the Godhead, it humbles our pride and it heightens our sense of speechless privilege, and it prompts our deepest adoration. We began at the beginning thinking about, unless we live in denial, we have to face the fact that the future, for us at least, seems uncertain. The world does seem like this threatening jungle. And in many ways, from that perspective, insecurity seems perfectly rational. But actually, as we grasp what is happening here at the cross, it changes everything. Earlier this year, I got to go on this big, like enormous sort of fairground ride with, you're in a little pod, and the pods are going round and round, plus they're going in and out on their spokes, plus they're going up and down, and each one of them is spinning round. And when you're in it, it just feels absolute chaos. But then when you kind of step away and stagger a little bit and you see other people on it, you realise that it's been very carefully engineered. So that even though for the people in the midst of it, it feels chaotic, it's perfectly choreographed. And the cross teaches us that appearances can be deceptive. That actually you and I do not live in a chaotic jungle. We live in a world where even the worst things in life are perfectly choreographed by God as part of a perfect, loving plan for His glory and for His people's good. And we live in a world where evil, horrible as it is, has been decisively defeated. It may be a horrible monster, and we know and experience the horror of it still, but it has received its death blow. So we can face the future positively. We know that one day evil will be totally vanquished. I've got a friend a few years older than me, and every birthday she says, one year closer to glory. The future is not to be feared. The devil has been conquered. The future is bright. So when those nagging insecurities come about the future, about the world, about ourselves, we don't need to give in to those insecurities. In fact, as we soak in this assurance that we receive in Jesus' victory at the cross, we can live day to day in joyful confidence. Because although we don't know the future ourselves, we know the one who does. And we've been caught up in this wonderful, perfect, unstoppable plan. We're going to sing in a moment about the perfect wisdom of our God in every situation in life. But first, let's have a moment's quiet before the Lord to consider what He's saying to each of us personally.